Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Liz Pelka reporting. A roadblock for a U.S. healthcare vote. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he will delay a procedural vote on a revised Republican healthcare bill. McConnell's announcement follows the news that Senator John McCain must remain in Arizona for a week following an operation Saturday to remove a blood clot above his left eye. McCain's absence in the closely divided Senate places the vote on the healthcare bill in jeopardy. In his weekly address, President Trump said the new health care bill will replace the old national plan. An Iranian court has sentenced a U.S. citizen to 10 years in prison on infiltration charges. That's according to Iran's judicial spokesman on Sunday. The individual, whose name was not released, is a dual citizen of the United States and another unspecified country. Iran has detained and sentenced several dual nationals from the United States, Britain, Austria, Canada, and France for charges including espionage and collaborating with hostile governments. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says those behind last year's failed coup in Turkey are traitors who should be beheaded. The United States has condemned the coup but has disagreed with Ankara on several issues. Erdogan blames his U.S.-based political opponent, Fethullah Gulen, for masterminding the coup and demands his extradition. The U.S. government has refused to extradite Gulen without substantial evidence. Former U.S. ambassador to Ankara, James Jeffrey.
That gets into very complicated stuff. I haven't seen the proof, but I would be surprised if there's a whole lot of proof, because if you're going to do something like that, you typically don't leave a paper trail.
For more on this story, go to voanews.com. This is VOA News. French President Emmanuel Macron and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu honored the victims of a mass deportation of French Jews to Nazi camps during the Holocaust. Fewer than 100 people survived after 13,000 people were rounded up and sent to concentration camps in July of 1942. The Prime Minister spoke at the memorial on Sunday.
What happened here on that day in the heart of Paris, multiplied by 400 times. 400 Parises, and you will get the scale, the enormous scale of the destruction of European Jewry, and the destruction of our children.
Macron met with Netanyahu later on Sunday for separate talks. The Israeli-Palestinian peace process, the Iran nuclear deal, and French-Israeli technological cooperation were all on the agenda.
We share a desire to see a stable and peaceful Middle East. We discussed both the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but also the growing opportunities for cooperation between Israel and some of our Arab neighbors because of this sense, a new sense, of shared threats and shared interests.
On Sunday, Iraqi police paraded through Baghdad in celebration of the recapture of Mosul from the Islamic State group IS. Mosul is the second largest city in northern Iraq and was the militants' primary stronghold in the country. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi announced the liberation of Mosul on the 10th of July. U.S. officials interviewing refugees held in an Australian-run offshore detention center left the facility abruptly, three detainees told Reuters on Saturday. U.S. officials halted screening interviews and departed the Pacific island of Nauru on Friday, 2 weeks earlier than they had initially planned. This came a day after Washington said the United States had reached its annual refugee intake cap. Here's Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop earlier today.
The United States is upholding the agreement. We have been given assurances by both President Trump and Vice President Pence and others that the agreement will be adhered to. And the United States, like Australia, has a quota each year for its refugee intake. I understand that the quota has been fulfilled for this year. It kicks over again on the 1st of October. But I have no doubt that this agreement is progressing, as the relevant US authority confirmed this morning.
An indefinite postponement of the deal would have significant repercussions for Australia's pledge to close a second detention center on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island. I'm Liz Pelka in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I don't know why the world would be interested or should even be following up the Rwandan direction, because the Rwandan direction is not different from what you have as a North Korean direction.
Rwandan political parties campaign in the run-up to the August 4 presidential election.
The ground really is merely talking about the freak accident that happened to his wife, Grace Mugabe. There isn't any specific information about Mugabe's health himself.
The Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe returns home after medical treatment abroad.
We found this as an unfortunate situation, and immediately we tried to engage the Minister of Gender, because that's the coordinating minister which interfaces with NGOs.
And Malawian civil society and NGOs are displeased with a new government measure seeking to clamp down on their activities. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Independent candidate Philippe Mpayimana and main opposition leader Frank Habineza from the Democratic Green Party have launched their campaigns seeking to unseat long-time incumbent Rwandan President Paul Kagame. Kagame is widely expected to win since he had won previous elections with over 90% of the total vote count. But critics say elections in Rwanda have not been credible, contrary to reports by local and international observers that the polls have been transparent and fair. For analysis of the situation in Rwanda, I reached Lieutenant General Ambassador Kayumba Nyamwasa, a former Chief of Defence Staff of the Rwandan Defence Forces in Johannesburg, South Africa.
I don't know why the world would be interested or should even be following up the Rwandan election, because the Rwandan election is not different from what you'd have as a North Korean election, because the process is actually the same. President Kagame has already declared that the results of the elections are already known. So essentially then, what is the purpose of having the elections? But the most telling and most important is there was a fictitious referendum that took place in Rwanda.
Approximately 4 million people overwhelmingly demanded the amendment of the constitution to enable him to run again. Are you saying that assertion is wrong?
Of course, you see, it is fictitious in the sense that, you know, just like a lot of Rwandans were forced to go and carry out genocide, it's the same method that was used to force people to go and carry out a fictitious referendum. Rwanda is a country like any other on the African continent, but also in the community of the whole world. Where would you expect a referendum of 98% outcome and call it a credible outcome? That one is only possible in a dictatorship, in a despotism. That's why it is only possible. But in a democracy, you don't get those figures.
I understand you were part of the process during the first election, and that you and some of your colleagues could determine which percentage presidential candidate got in the election.
Well, it was not me, but I know it was from Kagame. Kagame would just call the chairman of the electoral commission and tell him the percentages he wanted. And it's a fact, in 2003, what he wanted was 95%, and that's what he was given. Although I know some sycophants within the system wanted 100%, but then when you look at the outcome of the referendum, 98% and 100% is almost the same. So what is true is that the electoral commission in Rwanda never goes with the outcome of the elections. It goes with what President Kagame and maybe the RPF have told him to declare. And that's what it is.
Now, is this what you fought for? Because one of the overarching aim of fighting to come to power was to liberate Rwanda and to ensure democracy. Is this what you fought for?
That is the biggest travesty, because the war in Rwanda, the so-called war of liberation, claimed very many lives on both sides. with the people who are fighting, but also the genocide. And remember, at that time, we were fighting for establishing a democracy in Rwanda. And we were choosing President Habyarimana at that time of rigging elections and allocating himself 95-98% of elections at that time. Exactly the same figures are the ones which Kagame is allocating to himself. So there is no change. More so, we thought we were going to establish a rule of law whereby people could live in their country free of fear. Today, when you look at the Rwandans, look at their faces, they are not different from the people in North Korea. If you look at Kagame's rallies, you'll see people holding 3, 4, 5 flags. Why do you have to hold 3, 4, 5 flags? It's simply because people are forced. People go for rallies, they start lining up at midnight, having hoarded into areas by the military, and then Kagame comes 12 hours later. That shows you exactly the climate. Rwandans today are running into exile. Political leaders are now incarcerated in prisons in Rwanda. Others have now disappeared. And what you would call political parties, opposition political parties, are also supporting Kagame. Where in the history of the world would you find some people who are supposed to be opposition parties actually supporting the ruling party and the cabinet of the ruling party? It can only happen in North Korea and in Rwanda.
But there are two candidates now who are challenging him, Frank Habineza of the Democratic Green Party and Philippe Mpayimana. You don't think they stand a chance?
No. One thing is, you see, the Green Party is part of the political forum in Rwanda, whereby all political parties are dumped together in a forum, and they must talk with the same voice. And the Green Party is in there. Now, Mpayimana is a guy who never actually presented anything to the Electoral Commission. He never even gave a list of his signatories. When the time for giving out the requirements, he had already gone back to France because he had given up. So Kagame is calling him back just to give a semblance of an opposition of a person who actually did not even contest. And therefore, the whole thing is a sham.
Lieutenant General Ambassador Kayumba Nyamwasa is a former Chief of Defense Staff of the Rwandan Defense Forces. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. The Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe returned home on Saturday after medical treatment in Singapore. The state broadcaster announced that the president was in Singapore for a routine medical checkup where he had eye surgery a few years ago. Some Zimbabweans have expressed worry about the president's health, saying the government did not provide any information about the whereabouts of the 93-year-old leader. Meanwhile, First Lady Grace Mugabe twisted her ankle on the president's arrival. For the latest development, I reach Rejoice Ngwenya, an independent political analyst in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
The ground really is merely talking about a freak accident that happened to his wife, Grace Mugabe. There isn't any specific information about Mugabe's health himself. But I suppose, it's a perennial issue that every time Mugabe comes back from Singapore, the nation expresses concern. And they have a right to be concerned because he's a president who is over 93, and we are concerned that if an old man is leading us, anything can go wrong, and we have a right to really ask questions. What type of people are around Mugabe who can punish him so much as not to give him time to rest?
Well, I understand he attends all meetings, hold cabinet meetings, and is campaigning as well. Will he be able to withstand the rigors of the campaign ahead of next year's election?
Absolutely not, because we know that he had scheduled to do about 10 youth rallies, and so far he has done about 3, and the other one has been cancelled. So we really shudder to think that this is the man who is going to be handling star rallies next year, because it's going to be very, very competitive. So I have my doubts that this man is going to be able to sustain the rigors of electioneering.
But his wife, Madame Grace Mugabe, says that the husband is fit and he's going to win the election. Even Zimbabweans will vote for his corpse if he were to die, she says.
Well, it's expected. I mean, this whole family, this whole dynasty is benefiting from Mugabe's position. And who would not say that her husband is going to win? I think she doesn't have any empathy, any mercy, because the reason why Mugabe can win an election is not because he's campaigning, but because of state capture. He controls all institutions. So I do not think that his enthusiasm and his fitness can be able to to win in any election. If anything, really, it's an insult to the people of Zimbabwe.
What do you make of the assessment that many Zimbabweans think the opposition parties are not doing themselves any favor by presenting a splintered front and not united, making President Mugabe's victory perhaps feasible ahead of next year's election?
That's really a very good assessment because, Mugabe can call an election at any time. I mean, he's the president, he's got constitutional power. So if he calls a snap election and by now the opposition have not branded a single political, presidential candidate, maybe they don't care about having a single candidate. But whatever the situation is that the opposition is not doing itself a favor. And I think, if they are really serious, they should be able to put their house in order and be able to present a single candidate. They can start branding now.
How competitive do you think next year's election will be? And how significant a challenge do you think the opposition can pose to President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF?
I'm a liberal and I believe in free market competition. Really, the number of candidates and the quality of candidates will always be the same as previous elections. But I think because of the fractured behavior in ZANU-PF itself, the Lacoste and G40 confusion, that is going to weaken its ZANU-PF's ability to deal with opposition. But I still think that the opposition, fractious and divided as it is, there's still a fleeting opportunity to be able to reduce the parliamentary majority of ZANU-PF. And I still think that they're still in the game.
Some people are telling me that the opposition should do well to break the monopoly of the ZANU-PF in the rural areas. That is what they think will make them stand a chance of defeating the ZANU-PF in the presidential election. Do you share in that assessment?
That's kind of true because the electoral, demographics are very clear that 60% of the voters are based in rural areas. And this is where ZANU-PF has its highest influence. They control the traditional leaders, they control the mass media, they control the police. They, in fact, determine who does what meetings in rural areas. So it is very important for the opposition to make serious inroads and start communicating directly with rural areas so at least they get a better chance. But look, if there is electoral reform, I believe that the rural areas will still be a possible cake to cut for the opposition.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. Civil society and non-governmental organizations say a new policy the Malawian government plans to implement seeks to undermine their effectiveness. The groups say they are displeased that the administration appears to lack the political will to address their concerns about the new policy. If passed into law, the proposed measure will equip a government-backed regulatory body to ban groups that breach laid-down rules and regulations. For reaction regarding the new policy, I reached Robert Nkwazalamba, the Executive Director for Human Rights Consultative Committee, an umbrella body for human rights and non-governmental organizations.
We found this as an unfortunate situation, and immediately we tried to engage the Ministry of Gender because that's the coordinating ministry which interfaces with NGOs. In actual sense, by the time we got this news, government had gone advanced stages to start pushing the amendments to be effective, and that was early 2016. But through the initiative of CSOs, we convened press conferences to denounce the policies and the programs that government was rolling out. There was a consensus where we sat down and government abandoned this process. Unfortunately, 2 months down the line, they did the same, abandoned us, and as we speak, we are still at a standstill where government has advanced this on issues in the NGO policy and the CSOs. We have countered and raised our concerns to say we do not want to be bound by this policy because it is unfavorable and wants to cut down on NGOs.
Has the government expressed willingness to negotiate or have a dialogue with non-governmental organizations and civil society organizations in Malawi to address some of these concerns that you're expressing?
I would say at two fronts, we still have the political leadership not interested to engage by the numerous acts that they are involved in. However, through other structures, we have what is a national advocacy platform, which is a combination of over 60 NGOs and 13 network and umbrella organizations. We engage the principal secretary for gender And through that meeting, she appreciated the submissions that the NGO community had, and she declared that she had made a decision to suspend the discussions towards the formulation of a new NGO Act. However, she was waiting also to hear from the other operatives, like from government, because our team comprises also of international NGOs, and it became difficult for her ministry to proceed with the efforts of putting in place an NGO Act which was not responsive to the needs of CSOs.
But the government needs to regulate the work that civil society organizations or CSOs perform in the country. Those that breach certain rules need to be punished. Don't you think so?
Yes, we agree. We have no problem with the us being regulated. However, the provisions that are in the NGO policy, as well as the Act itself, speaks to, for instance, to an extent it has removed the element of NGOs being those that are concerned with governance, human rights, and rule of law, which to an extent tells you that if the law becomes effective, you may have no local stand as NGO to question issues of governance, rule of law, or otherwise.
The government has sharply denied accusations from NGOs and civil society organizations that this measure or policy they are coming up with is meant to stifle dissenting views or NGOs and civil society organizations critical of the administration in Lilongwe.
Basically, what we're looking at is the element of clamping down exactly as it is being feared, because more importantly, the governance NGOs, as I mentioned, issues of human rights, governance, rule of law have not been adequately captured. But what these amendments are proposing is to have the NGO board turned into an authority. And this authority will also be the spokesperson and the voice of NGOs in Malawi. So it will register NGOs, but it also speaks for NGOs. Two different roles, which tells us that we will not have a platform and a forum under which to criticize the ruling structure or ruling government, or to operate freely as independent and bona fide entities. So yes, it is all meant to silence us, especially as we move towards 2019, when we are going to have presidential and parliamentary elections.
Robert Nkwazalamba is the Executive Director for Human Rights Consultative Committee. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. A Kenyan charity is working to prevent violence as the country goes to the polls in August. The Shalom Center for Conflict Resolution and Reconciliation was founded in response to the post-election violence in 2007. The group empowers communities in volatile regions to keep the peace and encourages warring groups to lay down their arms. Father Patrick Devine, an Irish Catholic priest, is the founder of the Shalom Center. For VOA, Ruben Chiama asked him how the idea got started.
Well, I first came to Africa in 1988. An Irish man, an Irish missionary, and began working in Western Tanzania. In the course of the last 29 years, I've had many, many different experiences in the realm of peace and development. When I look back on issues of conflict in Africa, I was particularly touched by the conflict that happened in Rwanda in 1994 and the disastrous impact that had on the people there and on the country and on the social, political, economic prosperity of the people. Then in my own career, I have ended up in a lot of roles of administration through the Religious Superiors Conference of Kenya, which would have been made up of approximately 5,000 personnel spread all over Eastern Africa. And during my time in that role as chairman and as the chief executive, the secretary general, I became aware of many, many conflict environments where people were killed and maimed and displaced persistently. And I looked at the role of the church and a lot of NGOs, and predominantly, they were very, very good at addressing the symptoms of conflict, the symptoms of poverty, the symptoms of migration. But very few had the skill sets or the qualifications to address the underlying causes. And I began to ask myself, after around 25 years working here, engaged in development projects, water, schools, hospitals, etc., did I wish to spend another 25 years just dealing with the symptoms, or did I really want to tackle the underlying causes? underlying causes. And it was out of that mindset that the Shalom Center for Conflict Resolution and Reconciliation was founded.
Could you give us some of these underlying factors, economic, historical, and maybe religious, that, for example, have influenced the solution, one of the conflicts your group is actually addressing?
Take, for example, in the northern Kenya, in the area where Kenya interfaces with Somalia, Ethiopia, South Sudan and Uganda, some of the key problems causing interethnic conflict are around the following issues. Of course, core resources, which is really to do with environmental resources, not just their scarcity, but also the management of what they have. Second, in some of the conflicts, you have issues of cultural variation, different cultures and different issues creating clashes between the people based on their own cultural traditions. Thirdly, you have contested territory, customary land mostly, contested territory about access to water and pasture. Fourthly is the whole area of infrastructure insecurity, the lack of institutions in terms of roads, communications, law and order, legal redress, medical education, all of these things which are crucial to help people to meet their basic human needs and to actualize their potential. And you put all that into a boiling pot together, you get a social pressure cooker, right, generating conflict. And that also is contaminated by the proliferation of small arms. So there's not one monocausal explanation. It's a multiplicity and it needs a multidisciplinary approach. And that's why Shalom has people with qualifications from many disciplines who are committed to working persistently inside in the conflict environment.
Kenya is gearing up for another election next month. Could you share with us some of the initiatives as Kenya heads for the next election?
Apart from working up in this northern area of Kenya and where it interfaces with the surrounding countries, we're also very, very involved in the slum areas, the poor areas of urban cities here, particularly in Nairobi, Kibera, Matare, Kariobangi area, also in Nakuru, Naivasha, places where were the hot spots of conflict. Back in, 2008, we had over 1,250 people killed in the post-election violence, 60,000 maimed, and over a half a million displaced. Coming up to these elections, now we have completed over 60 workshops right across all those hotspots. So what are we really focusing on is preparing the influential opinion shapers in those environments with the skill sets, right, to analyse what has caused conflict in the past and what can be, in terms of structures and institutions, improved to ensure that violence doesn't happen in the upcoming elections. So we go in there, we're training them people, and we're also helping them to devise action plans. It's their community and they have an obligation and they have a right to ensure that all the institutions are in place in terms of election preparedness for the prevention of election violence and to ensure that we have fair and just elections.
Father Patrick Divine is the founder of the Kenyan-based Shalom Center for Conflict Resolution and Reconciliation. He spoke with Ruben Chiama in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. After a week-long recess, Senate Republicans returned to Washington searching for a legislative formula to repeal and replace former President Barack Obama's health care law, known as Obamacare. VOA's Michael Bowman reports from Capitol Hill.
Conservative Republicans want to dramatically pare back the federal government's role in health care, but moderates worry that their poor and vulnerable constituents would lose coverage. However, discussions play out among Republican senators. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says the status quo is not working.
Obamacare has been hurtling toward collapse for years. Today, it sits on the edge of total meltdown. Unless we do something about that, even more Americans are going to get hurt. And we have a responsibility to help before Obamacare comes literally crashing down around them.
McConnell has said that if his caucus can't agree on a bill, Republicans will have no choice but to shore up Obamacare, which has seen premiums rise and insurers flee health care exchanges in many states. Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer seized on McConnell's comment, insisting Obamacare's flaws can be fixed without ditching the entire law.
Republican leadership is not telling their members, vote for this bill because it's a good bill. Nope. They're saying, vote for this bill or you'll have to work with Democrats. When you can't defend the substance of the bill at all, it's time to move on.
McConnell postponed a vote on an initial Republican health care plan after the Congressional Budget Office estimated it would cause millions to lose coverage. Republican leaders hope to present a revised bill by the end of the week. Michael Bowman, VOA News, The Capitol.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with tennis, where Roger Federer has just beaten Croatia's Marin Cilic. Roger Federer becomes the first man to win Wimbledon 8 times and has now extended his record to 19 Grand Slam titles. The Swiss third seed won 6-3, 6-1, 6-4, as seventh seed Cilic struggled with blisters on his left foot and broke down in tears during the second set. The 35-year-old Federer finished the contest in 1 hour and 41 minutes to claim his first Wimbledon title since 2012. He becomes the oldest man in the Open era to win the Wimbledon title. Meanwhile, on Saturday, Spain's Garbine Muguruza won her first Wimbledon title with a straight set win over 5-time champion Venus Williams. The 23-year-old won in a 7-5-6-0 victory under the center court roof. Muguruza denied the 37-year-old a first major title for 9 years, which would have made her the oldest female Grand Slam champion in the Open era. It is 14th seed Muguruza's second Grand Slam title after her French Open triumph over Serena Williams in 2016. She lost Serena Williams in the 2015 final, but she is also the first woman to beat both Williams sisters in Grand Slam finals. Moving on to football, Sudan was readmitted to international football by FIFA on Thursday, but the decision came too late to prevent two of the country's clubs from being knocked out of the African Champions League. The global soccer body said in a statement that it had lifted the suspension imposed on the Sudanese Federation over a decree issued by the country's Ministry of Justice last month. In the meantime, two Sudanese clubs, both with chances of reaching the African Champions League quarterfinals, forfeited their games 3-0 and as a result were knocked out of the competition. Khartoum's two most popular clubs, Al Hilal and El Merrikh, were paired in the same group in the Champions League and both still had a chance to qualify for the next round. But with their matches against Etoile Sahel of Tunisia and Ferroviario Beira of Mozambique forfeited, their opponents advanced. Finally, 8 people have died and at least 49 are injured after a wall collapsed at a football stadium in Senegal. It happened at a stadium in the capital, Dakar, at the end of the League Cup final between Stade de Mambour and Union Sportive Oukouam. Fighting started between rival fans and police responded by using tear gas, which led to panic, a stampede, and the war collapse. With a score 1-1 after 90 minutes, Mboa scored in the first period of extra time to win 2-1, and violence broke out at the final whistle. A spokesman for the country's president, Macky Sall, said the campaigning for upcoming elections would be suspended on Sunday as a mark of respect. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Me too.
chisera domzikita msana mze sichalosi sichalosi mze sichalosi ndi boss sichalosi dance dance yefaba bubu kempumulo yefaba bubu kempumulo akalero kansonga kakuye ndi mumudu ya chigoma Sagala nyombo, kubange ino sawa ya nungu Bagambe sagala nyombo, ino sawa ya chikiri Mwama sembera, ulamu wasova Jangu chachare, yansiri akulika Mlekanzine, nenzina mumama Ulamu wajisera, ato muziki zuri sana Mlekanzine, nenzina mumu Ulamu wajisera Sana, the Sichalosi, Sichalosi, the Sichalosi, the boss, Sichalosi, dance, dance, Abande, Unobula Mumbi, Zimbabwe, Kalimunde, Kenangi, when the Jupiter Mutem foot, and those at the Kuvana, Acholeka, Otada, never came to Kanga. Itali musana, oh mama, oh la la, yeah. Oh agaliba, oh agaliba,
kati toba kona chungamba, jango mziki tugusambi, kambe toba kona chungamba, jangwe nutwe changi,
aye le 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 le, aye le 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 le,
le kanzine,
nenzina mumama, ulamu wajisera, ato mziki zuri sana,
le kanzine,
Zina
I'm I go Calabar, I see gospel of that go. You dash the body, I go Bola for Lagos. I call Lorenzi, say I don't have a people club. Where all the babies, say where they come, they are the club. I say she's E40, E40, that means they sing songs. I'm bad like King Kong, E Calabar.
Testimony.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Perhaps as a result of the lengthy passage of time, very few Africans will recall that there was a time when the Organization of African Unity, the predecessor of the current African Union, discouraged the establishment of foreign bases on the African soil. But that was the time of the Cold War, when the alliances of the East and West, NATO and Warsaw Pact, were searching for forward bases in their global struggle. Since the end of the Cold War, African views have been undergoing changes, although when it was rumored some time ago that the U.S. African Command may be located on the African soil, many African states strongly objected, and then President Bush had to go to Accra, Ghana, to affirm that the United States had no intention of having military bases on continental Africa. Now, China has just established its first military base outside of China in Djibouti. In an agreement that was signed between Djibouti and China, China could set up a naval base with a military contingent of up to 10,000 soldiers until 2026. As you know, Djibouti is located in the Horn of Africa, a very strategic position. And the government of Djibouti has mastered the art of using its strategic position to enhance its own insecurity and economic development. Of course, China is not the only country with a military base in Djibouti. The French and the United States have military bases in Djibouti, and there is a report that Saudi Arabia has signed an agreement for its own military base in Djibouti. China has emphasized that its military base in Djibouti is more of a logistic base than a base for projecting power. They recall that China now has peacekeeping forces in Africa. It is engaged in humanitarian activities in Africa and also is involved in the fight against those wishing to obstruct naval shipping in the Indian Ocean. This, of course, has not lessened the concern of a country like India, which sees the new China base in Djibouti as something of a threat, which it calls a string of pearls of military alliances that China is using to encircle India. But the assurance of China has somewhat been endorsed by the African Union, because according to China's global television network, the African Union has welcomed the establishment of the naval base in Djibouti by China. The comparison one can make is that Djibouti has been following the example of maritime Singapore. Singapore is also in a very strategic position in Asia, where it controls the trade between many areas. And the fact that Singapore has enhanced its security and economy have been due to the quite good management of that government. So this may be what Djibouti is trying to do. So we have to see what are the developments, but one has to give credit to Djibouti that it has worked with all countries and not just with one country against another. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, where there is peace, dargis are used for shaving. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. sanctions on Russia will remain until Russia reverses the actions that triggered those sanctions, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson stated at a recent press conference in Kiev. In the case of eastern Ukraine, that means full implementation of the Minsk agreements. Secretary Tillerson added, the United States is disappointed by the lack of progress under the Minsk agreements, and introduced Special Representative for Ukraine Negotiations, Kurt Volker, who will be spearheading U.S. efforts to achieve the objectives set out in the Minsk agreements.
We do call on Russia to honor its commitments that were made under the Minsk Accords and to exercise influence over the separatists in the region whom they do hold complete control over. And we call on them again to immediately call on their proxies to cease the violence that is ongoing in East Ukraine.
The Minsk agreements consist of three separate documents that commit the sides to ensure a stable, reliable, and lasting ceasefire, to withdraw troops and heavy weapons, to create a buffer security zone, to release hostages, and to allow observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, to oversee the process. The long-term plan for peace also details a political process for reintegrating eastern Ukraine, including empowering local governments by decentralizing some political powers from the center and holding new OSCE-compliant elections. Now, despite signing the agreements, Russia is failing to live up to its most basic commitments, quieting the guns under the Minsk agreements. Russia must take steps to improve security in eastern Ukraine and ensure the safety of OSCE's Special Monitoring Mission, or SMM. SMM's 700 volunteers are entrusted with recording any violations of the ceasefire, as well as other aspects of the violence in eastern Ukraine. If it wanted to, Russia could take steps to stop this harassment. Secretary of State Tillerson called on Russia to honor its commitments.
Again, we call them to allow the monitors full access to all areas to perform their mission, not only along the line of contact, but ultimately along the border itself.
Secretary Tillerson called securing eastern Ukraine a fundamental element to Ukraine's sovereignty.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.